You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiatakis. 1 year ago, this week, the world first learned who George Floyd was.
Outrage at the death of George Floyd, an African-American man.
More protests and uprisings are expected in Minnesota and across the country this weekend over the death of George Floyd.
Rioting breaks out over the killing of a black man at the hands of police in Minneapolis. The anger taking hold across thousands.
In the immediate aftermath of his killing, millions of enraged Americans took to the streets. Minneapolis, New York, Philadelphia, Los Angeles. George Floyd's murder ignited the largest civil rights movement since the 1960s. Last month, a jury convicted Derek Chauvin, the Minneapolis police officer who killed him, guilty of second and third degree murder. KCRW's Danielle Chiriguayo has been connecting with black Americans all over Southern California to talk about the year since, whether there's been progress, whether there's been change or not. And she joins me right now. Hey, Danielle.
Hey there, Steve.
So you've been talking to some people who have been reflecting on how their lives have changed because of the killing of George Floyd, of course, others as well. What are you hearing?
Quite frankly, Steve, folks are just exhausted. They're tired. Take a listen here to Celia Mandela Rivera. She's a black woman who lives in South LA.
It's tiring. It's tiring having to learn another name and who they were, if they were a father or a daughter, or you're trying to defend this person's life and share why their life mattered and share why they didn't deserve to die.
And when you're adding in a global pandemic, gosh. Jenny Vasquez Newsom, she's a 39-year-old black mom from Santa Monica. She said she was already overwhelmed even before she heard about George Floyd.
I'm hearing that a video is circulating social media and your heart sinks. And so it just felt like this time period of, you know, a lot of death and black death and black murder at that time. And so it just felt like it really another gut punch.
For Cynthia Dominguez of Culver City, George Floyd's murder felt like not just one more thing in a crazy year, but one more trauma for Los Angeles. She was thinking back to 1992.
1992, of course, when the unrest happened. After the beating of Rodney King and four police officers were acquitted in Simi Valley, that's what you're talking about. That's what she's talking about, right?
Yeah, exactly, Steve. Dominguez, she lived in Koreatown when whole buildings were on fire while others were looted. She remembers standing inside her third floor apartment building and watching armed gunmen on rooftops defending local businesses.
It was a crazy, crazy time. And I think the thing that reminded me so much of that is just how little had changed in so long. We had video. We saw what happened. We all saw that it was wrong, and it didn't matter.
It didn't matter because, as you said, the four police officers in that case were acquitted of beating Rodney King, even with clear video evidence.
So when George Floyd was killed a year ago tomorrow, here they are expressing this real sense of here we go again, right?
Exactly. I mean, listen to how 35-year-old Kai King from Rialto puts it. It's like all the deaths that came before him cast a shadow over his own life.
It's kind of like inbred. It's almost like a generational curse or generational trauma. I have to be mindful of what it is that I'm doing, what it is that I'm wearing. Because more often than not, every time on the news, it's 6 feet tall, about 100 to 200 pounds. African-American male. I fit that description.
Another thing I heard, Steve, besides that sense of exhaustion, was a feeling like George Floyd's death actually finally made people stop and listen. That his murder and that agonizing 9-minute and 29-second video finally opened the eyes of non-black folks.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess because the video of Derek Chauvin, police officer, with his knee on George Floyd's neck. I mean, it was so graphic. I mean, it was everyone saw it, right?
Right. And everyone reacted to it immediately. Cynthia Dominguez tells me that because everyone saw the video, she's been able to change how she interacts with people in the last year. She says that now she's doing her damnedest to call out racism or prejudice wherever she sees it, even in the workplace.
As a culture, especially my age group, we've learned, or we were taught, in order to succeed or to go forward in this corporate kind of America world, you kind of had to defer to white men. I make a joke all the time that if I made you uncomfortable, then I did my job for the day. I need you to feel uncomfortable about some of the things that you say. You should not feel comfortable saying them so that when you're in a room and there are no brown or black people in the room, you think twice about letting someone else say it. And that's, I think, where I changed the most, is I'm no longer afraid to do that.
So she's saying, Danielle, that she's no longer putting up with this, you know, casual racism or these microaggressions that she's experienced around her anymore.
Not at all, Steve. I heard something similar from Celia Mandela Rivera. She says that she's lost friends, left entire social circles, and even parted ways with someone who was supposed to be a bridesmaid in her wedding.
If we can't see eye to eye that I'm experiencing what I am experiencing, that's alarming, and there needs to be distance. They have some growing to do, but it's not on me to fix every person, and it's not on me to help them along the way. That's not my burden. I feel like we're in two different realities, and that's alarming. And I need to remove myself, because now I don't feel like we can maintain a relationship that's safe, that's healthy. I'm on like chapter 42. And then some people haven't opened the book.
Cynthia Dominguez also told me that she hopes Derek Chauvin's conviction might just sway other cops to think twice while on the line of duty and maybe not be so quick to shoot.
I hope that if it doesn't do anything else than maybe give some police officer pause into thinking that if I pull this trigger, I could lose everything, because they can find me guilty. I may be the guy that they decide is the worst of the worst. I may be the next Derek Chauvin. I don't want to be. Even if that basic instinct part of him keeps him from shooting another black man, then that's hopeful. I hope that even if this verdict, even if all it does is give some police officers pause just for a moment from pulling a trigger, then I think, you know, that is something.
So she's obviously taking this horrible experience and saying maybe a police officer, law enforcement, can learn from this moment.
Yeah, absolutely. But I didn't hear that from everyone. Kai King from Rialto sees a long road ahead, in spite of all the awareness of police violence and the conviction of Officer Derek Chauvin.
No, for me, I don't think that it's changed anything. I don't think that the laws are going to change anything. I don't think that how we have camera phones and stuff like that is really going to change how police conduct themselves and how they ultimately view African-American men.
1 year tomorrow since the death of George Floyd, obviously a lot of feelings, a lot of passion behind what happened, change, not so much change. There are a lot of opinions, a lot of people talking about it, though. And I want to thank you, KCRW's Danielle Chiriguayo, for reporting on that story for us. Danielle, thank you.
Thank you, Steve.
KCRW's Drive to the Future provides essential support to KCRW, makes all of our news and cultural and music programs possible. We are in the final throes of this thing, which wraps this week, and we're turning to you to get us past that finish line. When you need local news coverage, be it the unrest in the wake of the police killing of George Floyd, the reactions in the years since, or maybe even a COVID update, homelessness, we talk a lot about that on this show. Where do you turn? Well, if your answer is KCRW, donate today. You know, we're there with music to uplift you as well, to renew your spirit with Morning Becomes Eclectic. Navina Carmel and Anthony Valadez giving you that music each and every day at 9 o'clock in the morning before we come on the air through the lunch hours. Support your source for innovative new artists and musicians. Support your source for the newsmakers whom you hear on this radio station, whether it be on Press Play or Greater LA. KCRW.com/give. Today, part of that contribution goes toward an organization called Heart of Los Angeles, OLA. For short, it provides underserved kids with after-school programs that include academics and arts, athletics, wellness. No cost to them, by the way. We're in the final stretch, though. The important thing is to support the station that supports you with news and culture and music programs. KCRW.com/give. And thank you.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
All right, onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. The Tokyo Olympics keep getting closer. Opening day just a couple of months away on July 23rd. Unfortunately, right now, Japan is facing a fourth wave of COVID-19. A lot of folks are concerned about the more than 10,000 athletes descending on Tokyo, not to mention the spectators, if they'll even be allowed. Well, we've been talking to some of the local athletes that have been working so hard to prepare for the games. One of them is Deja Mulapola. She's a catcher on the U.S. national softball team. She's from Garden Grove. She just graduated from the University of Arizona, and she's here to talk about her journey to Tokyo. Welcome, Deja.
Thank you so much for having me. Glad to be here.
Yeah, I mean, it must be a thrill playing on the U.S. national team and preparing for the Olympics. When did you find out that you'd be on that team headed to Tokyo?
Oh, yeah, I'm so grateful to be on this team. I've been playing in the summer for Team USA for about 4 years now, since my freshman year every summer. But I was invited to the tryout this October, and that same month I actually found out at the tryout that I had made the team.
You're in college.
Yes.
Are you in Arizona right now?
Yes, I am. We just won our regional championship last night, so we're moving on to super regionals.
Congratulations to you. I want to talk about, you know, being able to train with the national team. Have you been able to do that?
I have not been able to train with the national team because they're actually doing tour camps right now. But the three collegiate players that are actually still in school have the advantage of being with our college teams and our Olympic coaches who are able to prepare us for what to expect this summer.
How have y'all been affected by the pandemic? I mean, I know it's affected so many people and upended a lot of things, especially sports. What about for y'all?
Yeah, I mean, just testing, I think, is a big thing. Every single week we have to get tested and make sure that we're being safe. Fortunate for us, Tucson has opened up, and we were able to have a full stadium last night for our regional game. So that was awesome. We have a lot of vaccinated people out here. So we were lucky enough to have 100% capacity last night at our game.
You are a catcher. I want to, because, you know, softball seems a lot like baseball, right? You've got the pitcher's mound, you've got, you know, three bases and home plate. So, I mean, all of that is pretty much working the same, but there are some differences between softball and baseball. Tell us what they are.
Yeah, I think major differences are the length of the field. In baseball, it's about 90 feet to first base, and in softball, it's 60. And softball's a little bit more faster paced. I mean, we have a smaller field, like I said. We don't take as long to throw the ball. It's just the games are different. In softball, it's about maybe 2 hours max, and in baseball, it can be 4 to 5 hours, depending on how long the innings go.
And from pitcher's mound to where you are at home plate, you're the catcher, right?
Yes.
you can still get lobbed by a softball at whatever, 60, 70, 80 miles an hour, right?
Oh, yes, yes. From about 43 feet away.
I wonder if they're, you know, you hear a lot about women playing softball and men playing baseball. Like there's this gender thing.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, men's baseball, professional baseball, MLB, it's huge, right? There's really no female equivalent. Although if you go back to World War II, there was the All-American, right, Girls Baseball League.
Yeah.
That was a long time ago, though. what's going on with the two sports?
Yeah, I'm not too sure. I mean, women have just as much passion as men do. And it's actually funny because Coach Candrea said that if I was a male, I actually would be making millions of dollars right now. So, I mean, it's unfortunate for women, but at the end of the day, it's people like me and Team USA who are trying to put women's sports on the map and try to get us watched more so that we can get paid a little bit more, the same as baseball does. I mean, our sports are very similar, like you said earlier, and I just think that women need the recognition that they deserve, which is equal to men, if not even more.
It took a long time for softball, even baseball, to become official Olympic sports. I mean, softball didn't appear in the Summer Games until 1996 when the games were in Atlanta.
Yes.
But then in 2012 and 2016, softball and baseball were then dropped from the program.
Yes.
So they're back now. I know there are a lot of baseball fans in Japan. There's a big league there as well. Is that true for softball?
Yes, there are big softball and baseball fans out there. I mean, it's amazing. We have a lot of Team USA women who actually play overseas in the off time out there in Japan. So they love baseball and softball out there.
The U.S. has won 3 Olympic gold medals in softball. Japan's won 1.
Yes.
So that's all of them. Are there other countries with good softball teams that you're concerned about?
Oh, there's a lot of good countries out there. There's Canada, Mexico, Italy, Australia. But I think Japan and USA are big ones.
They going to be the toughest to beat, do you think, Japan?
I think so. They always are tough competitors. They know what we have and we know what they have. So it's always great competition.
I mentioned that COVID is again in Japan. We're not sure at this point whether the Olympic Committee will allow spectators to be in the stands. Are you concerned about anything along those lines with COVID? You said there was a lot of testing when you were at Arizona and training for the team, right?
I don't think I'm as concerned, just because our USA staff does a really great job of keeping us safe and making sure that we're doing the right things. And our safety is top priority to them. So, I mean, I'm not as concerned. I know they'll keep us safe, and I know we'll be in good hands.
What happens between now and July? I mean, are you going to be getting together with the national team to train? Is that going to happen in Arizona? How are you going to be doing that?
Yeah, so within the next couple of weeks, I mean, this weekend we're going to Super Regionals. And if we win, we advance to the Women's College World Series. And just depending how far I go into that, as soon as I'm done, a couple days later, I'm heading straight off to play with Team USA. And so there's no rest for me right now. I'm just go, go, go right now, and I love it.
What was the softball realm like in Garden Grove, California?
It's awesome. I mean, Southern California is a hotbed for amazing softball athletes. So it's the best of the best competition out there, and I was fortunate to be able to play for the Orange County Batbusters under Mike Stith and Mark Campbell. And I attended Pacifica High School under Mark Campbell as well. So I've always been coached under amazing softball coaches from Garden Grove and in that area. So I was fortunate to be one of the players to be coached by those legendary coaches.
Well, I want to wish you the best of luck. I know you got a lot on your plate. Go, go, go. Deja Mulapola from Garden Grove, catcher on the U.S. softball team, preparing to head to Tokyo for the Olympics in July. Best of luck to you, Deja, and the team.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Well, you're listening to Greater LA on KCRW. You know, orange is one of the colors of the pride flag, and it seems to be going up in a lot of places in Orange County. There's hope that the flag will eventually go up in Rancho Santa Margarita as well. There was a rally a couple of days ago on Harvey Milk Day at City Hall there, pushing for the rainbow flag to be raised for the month of June, Pride Month. Milk, of course, the first openly gay elected official in America. He was assassinated by a fellow San Francisco supervisor in 1978. Well, back to Orange County, with support growing in the region, the city could potentially join the ranks of others that have been flying those pride flags, adding to the growing rainbow of Orange County. LA Times columnist Gustavo Arellano is here for this week's KCRW Orange County Line. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
So local officials in Rancho Santa Margarita rejected a previous request, I guess, for the pride flag to go up at City Hall. But now there's a new petition. It's got hundreds of signatures. Do you think that, Saturday's rally and this petition will sway the city?
You would hope so. I mean, there's what can be possibly problematic about raising the pride flag for Gay Pride Month or LGBT Pride Month in Orange County. Well, of course, the answer is that there's a lot of problems. But the fact for these cities, which historically have been conservative, and especially Rancho Santa Margarita, that's in South Orange County, which has always been the more conservative area. One of the big overarching cultural touchstones there is Santa Margarita High School, a Catholic high school there. But the fact that you have over 1,000 people signing a petition, you would not have heard about to have the pride flag be raised at Santa Margarita, Rancho Santa Margarita City Hall. You would not have had that 5 years ago. So that's a step in the right direction.
A step in the right direction. Tell us a bit about the folks who are behind the push there.
It's just citizens, residents of Rancho Santa Margarita. Two women, one of them originally from Louisiana, identifies, I believe, as bisexual, comes here, lives in Rancho Santa Margarita and says, hey, I want to see, I want an affirmation from the city that says you think of me as a human being, which again, 20 years ago would have been a radical concept in Orange County, but now you're seeing more and more cities doing so, raising that pride flag, and to have in Rancho Santa Margarita, that would be a step to sort of break the real orange curtain, which is the curtain between North County and South County in Orange County, not the one that separates Orange County from LA County.
Yeah. Tell us about those cities. You say, other cities have done this. Which ones?
So the first one, interestingly enough, was Santa Ana, which most people, when they think of Santa Ana in Orange County, they only think about Latino issues, but it's also been a historical hotbed for LGBT folks in Orange County throughout its history. So they raised the flag unanimously on a city council vote in 2015. That's when they voted, and they've had it every year since. You've also seen it in Anaheim, Irvine, which makes sense. Even though it's kind of South Orange County, it's also a university town, historically progressive. Costa Mesa, one place where there's been a lot of controversy has been the Orange County Fairgrounds, which is technically county property, and it's been there every Pride Month since 2019. But the Orange County Fair Board is always debating about it, thinking, well, people are complaining about it, so maybe we should take it down because when it comes to the OC Fair, there shouldn't be any politics involved. And then another interesting city, Aliso Viejo, which is definitely in South Orange County, a couple years ago, they started to wave the Pride flag as well.
And Huntington Beach.
Huntington, oh my God, that's so unlikely, Huntington Beach, to
your
do
favorite
anything progressive
place.
That I forgot. Oh, I love Huntington Beach. On a 6-0 vote,
too.
Yeah, on a 6-0 vote, they, one absentation, they voted this year to raise a pride flag.
Does this, Huntington Beach and these other, Aliso Viejo, you mentioned South County, does this signal a trend, do you think, Gustavo, in Orange County? I mean, do you think this is proof that OC is continuing to maybe hue purple or maybe even turn bluer?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is, remember, in 2008, not even, 13 years ago, Orange County voters overwhelmingly voted for Proposition 8, which banned gay marriage in California, a proposition that did that. Now that you have more cities, and again, more city, wealthier cities in South Orange County slowly starting to do this or even consider it, yeah, it's very much the change of the political landscape in Orange County. Orange County, of course, is also the place where in the 1970s had something called the Briggs Amendment. John Briggs was an assembly member, state senator, I forget, from Fullerton, who wanted to make it illegal for LGBT folks to be teachers in California, among other things. It overwhelmingly lost in all of California, except Orange County. That was 40 years ago. John Briggs would be rolling in his grave right now if he knew what was happening in Orange County with LGBT issues.
Yeah, we talked about Harvey Milk at the outset, right? And Milk and Briggs, they debated one another about Prop 6.
Yeah, Really quick story on Harvey Milk and John Briggs. John Briggs said, San Francisco, it's a place of trash. It's a place of filth. Harvey Milk said, this was during a debate about the Briggs Amendment. Harvey Milk said, we had over 1 million tourists come to San Francisco this past year. How many tourists went to Fullerton? Boom, mic drop.
Don't drop the mic because it doesn't make a pleasant sound when that happens. But I do want to thank you, Gustavo Arellano, columnist for the LA Times with our KCAW Orange County line. Gustavo, as always, thanks.
Gracias.
Gustavo, never at a loss for words. That's going to do it for us this evening. Tomorrow, we take a deeper look at the past year and talk to an LA documentary filmmaker premiering his film on George Floyd's police death and the protests that ensued. That's coming up tomorrow on this program. A reminder that KCRW's Drive to the Future goes on. We're in the final throes, the final couple of days, asking you now to give to the station that supports you with news and culture and music shows that speak to your intelligence, to your flavors, to your heart. Donate now to help us reach the last and final $50,000 challenge grant. That means, you know, when you contribute to the radio station, it doubles, right? We get this challenge grant. If we get to $50,000, they'll double it thanks to our anonymous KCRW champions. It's not easy putting a show like this together each and every day. It costs money. We ask for your support right now at kcrw.com/give. You can also call toll-free 800-600-KCRW. And thank you, as always, for your support. We do appreciate it. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, PJ Shahamat, Ray Guarna, Amy Ta, Mario Saavedra, Phil Richards, Lorenzo Ponce de Leon, and Christian Bordahl all had hands on the show this evening. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for your ears. Have a great night.